Imagine finding like the literal Holy Grail hidden in some dark desert cave, bringing it back to civilization, and then, I don't know, accidentally selling it at a neighborhood yard sale for the price of a used bicycle.
Right, just completely giving it away.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a ridiculous comedy sketch. But in 1947, something very close to that actually happened, and it completely shattered everything we thought we knew about human history.
We are looking at the ultimate archaeological dream here. To really grasp this, I want you to picture the visual backdrop behind us just sort of fading into this dusty, sunlit cavern.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, filled with ancient, waist-high clay jars tucked away in the shadows of the Judean desert. And inside those jars are texts perfectly preserved for 2 millennia. It's a direct window into the exact moment before the modern world took shape.
Which is incredible. Welcome to this custom-tailored deep dive, everyone. We are looking at a stack of incredibly detailed research today, specifically drawing from the extensive lectures of Dr. Anthony J. Tomasino, and it's all about the Dead Sea Scrolls.
A huge topic.
Massive. And our mission today is simple. We are going to separate the tabloid fiction, like, the Weekly World News claiming these scrolls contained a wonderful brownie recipe.
I remember that one.
Right. Or that they predicted Saddam Hussein moving to New Jersey. We're separating all that nonsense from the actual revolutionary historical facts. Okay, let's unpack this, because this is arguably the greatest archaeological discovery of the 20th century.
Without a doubt.
I mean, it literally silenced critics who used to joke that the Bible was, quote, written last Tuesday. So I want you, listening right now, to imagine holding a text that bridges a 1,000-year gap in human history, just feeling that brittle parchment in your hands. But to really understand the gravity of these texts, we first have to understand the chaotic, almost comical way they were handled.
Yeah, the famous story from 1947 goes like this. A Bedouin shepherd is out near the Dead Sea,
Okay.
and one of his sheep wanders off up a steep, rocky hill. So he throws a rock at the sheep to drive it back, misses wildly, and the rock just sails into the mouth of a cave.
Okay, Matt.
Right. And a second later, he hears the unmistakable sound of breaking pottery echoing out of the darkness.
See, that sounds suspiciously perfect to me.
No, completely.
It has that manufactured kind of cinematic Indiana Jones quality to it, like a lucky rock throw, really.
Yeah, because that story was almost certainly a cover-up.
Really? A cover-up for what?
The reality of the situation was driven entirely by economics. These Bedouin tribesmen, they regularly scoured those treacherous cliffside caves looking for antiquities to sell on the illegal black market.
Oh, so they were basically tomb raiders.
They were essentially tomb raiders, yes. So when authorities inevitably started asking questions about where these priceless artifacts came from, the Bedouins weren't going to just confess to a massive illegal smuggling operation.
Right. Here's our crime ring, officer.
Exactly. They invented the story about the wayward sheep and the lucky throw of a rock as, an alibi.
Which is brilliant PR, honestly. I mean, you can't arrest a guy for having bad aim with a
You
stone.
really can't.
But what they actually pulled out of those jars, which was like an initial batch of 6 scrolls, including the massive Great Isaiah scroll, it completely changed biblical archaeology. And the crazy part is, they had absolutely no idea what they were holding.
None whatsoever. They just knew it looked old enough to sell. So they dragged this first batch of scrolls to an antiquities dealer in Bethlehem,
Yeah.
who eventually sold them to a Syrian Orthodox prelate named Mar Samuel. And the purchase price for this world-altering discovery was roughly 100 American dollars.
$100 for the greatest archaeological find of the century. That's wild.
Right. But Mar Samuel quickly realized the magnitude of what he had sitting on his desk. He turned around and offered them on the open market for $1 million.
Talk about a markup.
Exactly.
I
But nobody would touch them.
Wait, really? Why?
because the scrolls had suddenly become this massive political hot potato. They were discovered in a geographic region controlled by Jordan, but they had been physically brought into Israel.
Oh, so to the international community, they were basically stolen goods.
Exactly. Smuggled, stolen property. Eventually, though, a prominent Jewish scholar named Eliezer Sukenik managed to buy them in absolute secrecy. He negotiated through a middleman and got them for $250,000.
Okay, so they finally secure the first batch. But this black market chaos led to what has to be the most tragic comic disaster in the history of archaeology. The mutilation of the scrolls.
Yeah, this part hurts.
Word gets out to the Bedouin tribes that these weird leather rolls are worth an absolute fortune. So between 1952 and 1956, they start just tearing the caves apart looking for more.
Right. And the Israel Antiquities Authority found themselves in this desperate race against time. To stop the black market sales and keep the texts in the country, they made a sweeping offer.
Okay.
They announced they would pay the Bedouins a set flat price per square centimeter any scroll material they brought in.
Wait, hold on. If you pay per square centimeter...
You can see where this is going.
You're literally incentivizing impoverished people to chop a pristine, priceless, ancient scroll into confetti. Please tell me they didn't do that.
They did exactly that.
Oh, no.
The Bedouins looked at the economic reality of the offer and realized they could maximize their profit by taking a knife to these ancient texts.
That is just...
They cut them into tiny individual squares and brought them into the authorities a few centimeters at a time. The archaeologists' desperate attempt to save the scrolls inadvertently caused their destruction.
That is physically painful to hear. It's like someone shredded, 900 different encyclopedias, threw away half the confetti, burned all the index pages, and then asked you to reconstruct the articles using only tweezers and a magnifying glass.
That is exactly the nightmare scholars are still living today.
Yeah.
We ended up with roughly 30,000 disconnected fragments representing about 900 different texts.
30,000 fragments?
Yeah. Scholars literally still pop open a bottle of champagne when they find a single new match between two fingernail-sized fragments.
Which makes total sense. But, okay, if we have a 30,000-piece puzzle of cut-up parchment, how do you go from that to a revolutionary validation of the Hebrew Bible? Like, how does that work?
Well, we have to look at the timeline leap. Before the Bedouin shepherd threw that rock, supposedly threw that rock in 1947, every modern translation of the Old Testament you have ever read was based on a single medieval source called a Masoretic text.
Oh, okay.
This was essentially the master copy of the Hebrew Bible compiled by a specific group of Jewish scribes. And the oldest complete Hebrew manuscript we had of that text dated to about 900 A.D.
900 A.D., which is roughly, 1,000 years after the time of Jesus?
Yes.
And thousands of years after the original events supposedly took place?
Exactly. But the Dead Sea Scrolls date back to around 200 B.C.
Wow.
So in a single afternoon, scholars experienced an 1,100-year leap back in time. We suddenly have physical copies of the Bible in the original language, a full millennium older than anything humanity previously possessed.
Which is where the skeptics must have been rubbing their hands together, right? I mean, the prevailing theory for centuries was basically the telephone game. The assumption was that if you pass a story down for 1,000 years, copied by hand by hundreds of different monks and kings, all with their own political agendas, the text must have been drastically altered. Like, the 900 AD version should look absolutely nothing like the 200 BC version.
But the text proved the exact opposite. Over 1,100 years, the wording changed practically not at all. Let's look at the Great Isaiah Scroll, which survived intact.
Okay.
It is 95% identical to the Masoretic text from a millennium later. In Isaiah chapter 53, which is 166 Hebrew words long, there are only 17 individual letters that are different between the Dead Sea Scroll version and the text from 900 AD.
Wait, I mean, I have to push back here. 17 letters out of 166 words.
Yes.
If these scribes were copying massive texts by hand, probably under flickering candlelight, for over 1,000 years, how is it humanly possible that it barely changed? Didn't they just make, like, natural human mistakes? I mean, my grocery list has typos.
Well, this brings us to the mechanics of how the Masoretes and the scribes before them actually worked. They didn't view these texts as historical logs to be casually jotted down.
Right, they were sacred.
Exactly. These documents were fundamentally holy. They had meticulous, obsessive rules for copying. A scribe had to count every single letter on a page to ensure it matched the master copy perfectly.
Count every single letter?
Every single one. They had to ceremonially wipe their pens clean before writing the name of God. If a single mistake was made, like one slip of the pen, they didn't just cross it out.
They couldn't just use, like, ancient whiteout.
No. The entire page was destroyed and started over from scratch. And when a text finally got worn out from decades of use in the synagogue, it wasn't thrown in the trash.
What did they do with it?
Anything bearing the name of the Lord was ceremonially buried with the utmost respect. What's fascinating here is that the Dead Sea Scrolls physically validate the staggering, almost unimaginable accuracy of these ancient scribal mechanics.
That is wild. And it actually gets better, because where there were differences, the 200 BC scrolls ended up fixing long-standing translation errors that had confused scholars for centuries.
Oh, yes.
Like, there's this incredible example in Isaiah 14.4.
Right. So the King James Version, based on the 900 AD Masoretic text, translates that verse as referencing a golden city. It says, "How hath the golden city ceased?"
Which is pretty weird contextually.
It is. Translators for centuries had just guessed at that meaning, because the Hebrew word used there, mava, only appears that one single time in the entire Old Testament. It made very little contextual sense.
But then scholars unroll the Dead Sea Scroll from 1,000 years earlier, and what does it actually say?
It doesn't say matava, it says mahava.
Wait, just one letter difference.
The difference between those two words is literally one tiny flick of the wrist. The Hebrew letter daleth has a sharp right angle at the top, while the letter resh has a smoothly curved top.
Oh.
So in ancient faded handwriting, a sharp corner and a curved corner look almost identical. Some tired scribe around 500 AD likely misread a curved line as a sharp corner.
Wow.
And mahava comes from a very common root word meaning arrogant one. So instead of a bizarre isolated reference to a golden city, the true ancient translation is, "How hath the arrogant one languished?"
So a single curved line versus a sharp corner completely changes the translation. And this ancient time capsule caught the typo.
Exactly.
It also validated some highly contested Christian New Testament translations too, right? Like, look at Psalm 22.
Yes, Psalm 22 is heavily referenced by early Christians regarding the crucifixion. The medieval Masoretic text reads, "Like a lion are my hands and feet," using the Hebrew word ka'ari.
Like a lion are my hands and feet, which is a very confusing sentence.
Extremely confusing. But the New Testament writers quoted it as, "They have pierced my hands and feet."
Oh.
Yeah. And for centuries, critics loudly claimed that Christians deliberately altered the translation to invent a prophecy about crucifixion.
Right, that they just retconned it.
Yeah.
Exactly. But when scholars checked the Dead Sea Scroll of Psalm 22, the 200 BC text doesn't say ka'ari. It says ka'aru, which translates to pierced.
Wow.
So the scroll proved the New Testament writers weren't making things up. They were actually quoting an older, much more accurate version of the Old Testament.
That's amazing. But I mean, if they were so hyper obsessed with perfecting every single pen stroke of the Bible, they clearly weren't your average everyday scribes.
Yeah, not at all.
Like, who goes to these extremes, and what else did they write? Because when you look at the non-biblical texts they hid in those caves, the culture of this specific community gets weird fast.
It gets very weird. The contents of their library tell us exactly what this community valued and, frankly, what they absolutely despised.
Okay, give us an example.
Out of the 900 texts, we have multiple copies of Genesis, Deuteronomy, Isaiah, and Psalms. They are overrepresented, but there are zero copies of the Book of Esther.
Wait, why ban Esther? It's a massive part of Jewish history.
Well, the Book of Esther is fundamentally the story of a Jewish woman who marries a foreign pagan king to save her people.
Right.
This desert sect was violently, vehemently opposed to any intermarriage with foreigners. They viewed it as a corruption of their purity.
I see.
They hated the concept so much they completely excluded the book from their library. It just did not exist to them.
Which perfectly sets up the document they wrote called the Community Rule, or like the Manual of Discipline. Because I read the notes on this and I immediately thought of an ancient doomsday prep commune run by the world's strictest homeowners association.
That is the perfect analogy, the HOA of the ancient world.
Right.
It was an uncompromising, rigid order for life in their compound. They shared all meals and property, and they had unbending rules for every facet of human behavior.
How unbending are we talking?
The document dictates exactly who was allowed to speak at dinner, the precise order in which you could speak, and get this, it outlines strict punitive penalties for when you were and were not allowed to spit in public.
An HOA that actively regulates your saliva. That is intense. But hold on. Alongside the hyper-strict biblical purity rules, they also had some genuinely bizarre obsessions.
Very true.
Like, the scrolls contain magic texts, amulets to ward off demons, and horoscopes based on the bumps on your head, like ancient phrenology.
Yes, exactly.
But I thought we were talking about strict purists. On one hand, they're meticulously copying Deuteronomy, which explicitly forbids sorcery and magic. On the other hand, they're casting horoscopes based on your facial features to see if you're made of light or darkness. How do they justify that?
Well, we really have to view this through the ancient mindset rather than a modern theological one.
Okay, fair enough.
While the official Old Testament law banned magic as a pagan religious practice, The common ancient person didn't view defensive spells and anti-demon amulets as dark sorcery.
What did they view it as then?
To them, the world was teeming with invisible, malicious forces causing sickness and bad luck. Warding off a fever demon with an amulet was viewed the same way we view taking an antibiotic.
Oh, like early medicine?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Is early science or ancient medicine? They were attempting to understand and control the unseen forces in their environment.
Okay, but what about the head bumps?
Right, their horoscopes, based on physiognomy, the bumps on your head, were just a way to categorize people into their strict binary worldview. It was all about absolute light versus absolute darkness.
Okay, speaking of controlling unseen things, we have to talk about the Copper Scroll. This blew my mind.
Oh, the Copper Scroll is legendary.
Amidst all this fragile parchment and brittle animal leather, archaeologists unearthed a text inscribed entirely on pure sheet copper. And it reads like a literal pirate treasure map.
It really does. Yeah. It lists massive, almost unfathomable amounts of hidden gold, silver, and sacred temple artifacts. Mm-hmm. And it gives these very vague directions on where they are buried around Israel.
Did anyone believe it was real?
Not at first. Oh. When it was first translated, one prominent scholar publicly dismissed it as the demented ravings of an Essene. Well, you can see why. Because who goes through the grueling, physically demanding effort of punching Hebrew letters into heavy sheet copper just to write down a fantasy novel?
True. That's a lot of work for a prank.
Exactly. And today, the academic consensus has completely shifted. Scholars overwhelmingly believe it is authentic.
Wait, really? It's a real treasure map?
Yes. They believe it's a desperate, permanent record of actual Jerusalem temple treasures that were smuggled out and buried in the desert right before the great Jewish revolt against the Romans in 70 AD.
Wow. Okay, so if they were writing anti-demon amulets, hoarding copper treasure maps, and completely isolating themselves from society, they clearly weren't mainstream Jews living comfortably in Jerusalem.
No, definitely not.
So who are these rogue scribes?
Well, the Orthodox, most widely accepted theory for decades was that this was a group called the Essenes.
Okay.
The Essenes were a known ascetic Jewish sect, meaning they lived a lifestyle of severe self-discipline and abstention from all forms of indulgence, and they were spread around the Mediterranean.
But there's a glaring hole in the Essene theory, which jumped right out of the source material.
Let's hear it.
Out of 900 texts, 30,000 fragments, and millions of transcribed words, the word Essene never actually appears. Not once.
It doesn't.
They called themselves the Yahad, which simply means the community.
And that omission has driven a flurry of alternative theories. For example, the scholar Cecil Roth argued they were zealots, pointing to a specific scroll called the War Scroll, which details a highly militant apocalyptic 40-year battle against the Romans.
Okay, that makes sense.
Another faction of scholars argued they were Sadducees, based on some very specific interpretations of their water purity rituals.
There was even a massive best-selling theory that they were early Christians, right?
Yes, popularized heavily in the 1990s by writers like Robert Eisenman and Barbara Thiering.
What was their evidence for that?
Well, they pointed to the sect's revered leader, a figure the scrolls call the Teacher of Righteousness, who was violently persecuted by a figure called the Wicked Priest.
Sounds familiar.
Right. They saw the sect using phrases like New Covenant. They saw the communal meals, the baptism-like washing rituals, the intense focus on light versus darkness. And they concluded this community must be Jesus and the early church hiding in the desert.
But why doesn't that hold up?
It completely falls apart under basic scrutiny. First of all, the name Jesus, or Yeshua, never appears in the library.
Which feels like a big oversight if it was them.
Exactly. Second, the Teacher of Righteousness is never said to atone for anyone's sins or resurrect from the dead.
Right.
Third, the radiocarbon dating and archaeological timelines are completely wrong. These texts originated 100 to 150 years before Jesus was even born.
Oh, well, that pretty much seals it.
And finally, the theology is fundamentally opposed. Jesus famously taught his followers to love your enemies.
Yeah.
The community rule literally commands its members to hate the sons of darkness with a perfect hatred.
Yikes.
It is the exact aggressive opposite of the Sermon on the Mount. So today, the safest consensus is simply that they were an Essene-like sect, just a radical splinter group.
Well, whoever they were deeply, incredibly petty about the calendar. This part blew my mind.
Oh, the calendar wars.
Yes. There is a specific document called 4QMMT, and it details what scholars literally call the calendar wars.
The calendar was not just a petty administrative issue to the Yahad, though. It was the very hinge of their entire theology.
Really? How so?
Well, the rest of the Jewish world, including the priest running the temple in Jerusalem, used a lunar calendar, which is based on the phases of the moon.
Sure.
Now, a lunar calendar is fantastic for agricultural societies. A new moon means a new month. It tells you when to plant. But a lunar year is shorter than a solar year.
Right. The math doesn't quite line up.
Exactly. If you don't adjust it, your spring festivals eventually drift into the middle of winter.
I mean, imagine if we didn't use leap years and eventually the math got so skewed, we were setting off fireworks for the 4th of July in the dead of winter. That's what they thought was happening to God's calendar.
That's a great way to put it. The rest of the world would occasionally add a leap month to fix the drift. But the Scroll sect lost their minds over this.
Why?
They rejected the lunar calendar entirely. Based on a fringe text called the Book of Jubilees, they demanded a strictly solar calendar. And this wasn't an argument over a farmer's almanac. This was about salvation.
Salvation from a calendar.
Yes. They believed that God commanded the Day of Atonement to happen on one specific, mathematically perfect day of the year. So if the mainstream priests in Jerusalem are using a flawed lunar calendar, they are performing the sacred ritual on the wrong day.
Oh, wow. So what does this all mean for the sect then?
It means that in the eyes of the Yahad, the sins of the nation were not actually being forgiven. The entire temple system was invalid, corrupt, and damned.
Which is why they fled to the desert caves.
Exactly. They believed they were the only ones on earth doing it right.
And they were just waiting for God to violently overthrow that corrupt system in Jerusalem, which actually leads to their apocalyptic math. Because based on their reading of the book of Daniel, they confidently predicted that the ultimate day of vengeance against the Romans and the corrupt priests would happen exactly 40 years after their teacher of righteousness died.
They had a literal doomsday countdown running.
They did. And then the 40 years came and went, and nothing happened.
Nothing at all.
And the way they justified it is so deeply, painfully human. I mean, it's the ancient equivalent of predicting the end of the world, throwing a massive doomsday party, waking up the next morning with a hangover and saying, oh, wait, I forgot to carry the one.
Exactly. They wrote a sprawling commentary trying to explain away the failure. They concluded that God simply stretched out the timeline because his mysteries are inscrutable. Who are we to know the mind of God?
How convenient.
It is a textbook psychological rationalization for failed prophecy.
It really is. So if we pull back from all of this, what does this time capsule actually tell us about the human experience?
Well, this sect did not give birth to Christianity, but they shared a profound millennial anxiety. Both the Scroll sect and the early Christians lived on the absolute verge of the eschaton, the cares of the world as they knew it. Both groups firmly believed a new, perfect world was imminent.
Right.
And both groups had to grapple, theologically and emotionally, with what happens when the anticipated end simply doesn't arrive on schedule. It shows us how ancient people desperately tried to make sense of a chaotic world.
It really reminds you that underneath the massive, sweeping arc of ancient history, empires, and religion, it always comes down to people. We were talking about people who made spelling errors with a tiny flick of a pen.
Yes.
People who argued bitterly over leap years. People who hated their political rivals, clutched magic amulets when they caught a fever, and sat in the scorching desert anxiously waiting for a better world that never came.
It is a profoundly humanizing discovery.
Right.
I mean, from a Bedouin shepherd needing an alibi to cut up fragments sold by the square centimeter to desperate archaeologists.
Oh.
To an 1100-year time machine that verified the textual accuracy of the Bible while simultaneously revealing a militant sect obsessed with horoscopes and strict spitting rules.
It really is the ultimate time capsule. Which brings us to a final thought for you to ponder. This sect meticulously inscribed their most valuable world-ending secrets on heavy, pure copper.
Right.
They sealed their sacred parchment in thick clay jars. They carried them up treacherous cliffs and hid them in bone-dry, inaccessible caves. They did everything physically possible in the ancient world to ensure their truth survived the apocalypse.
And it worked.
It did. We are reading their exact words 2,000 years later. But it makes you wonder, if our modern world collapsed tomorrow, what physical evidence of our deepest beliefs would actually survive 2,000 years? Or would our entire digital reality, our clouds, our servers, our recorded histories, just disappear completely into the dark? Think about that. We finally opened the time capsule, and it perfectly reflected a world from 2 millennia ago. I just wonder if anyone will be able to do the same for us.